Hey, everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got a great episode for you today. I spoke with Chris Landon. He's the new-ish CEO of Natus Neuro. Chris is a friend of the podcast, a hater of pumpkin sausage, so it was great to have him back talking about not only his new role, but the role that mentors played in the development of his career and how he's helped others as a mentor. It's a great conversation about just about growing and learning from those who have done things that you want to do. So I hope you enjoy that talk with Chris. It's great to have him back. Make sure you register for next week's Device Talks Tuesdays. It will be historic. It'll be the first one that I'm not leading. Yes, that's right. The streak is over. Cal Ripken's record is safe. Kayleen Brown, our fantastic managing editor, will be taking over. And she's going to do an excellent job leading a conversation led by Azurio. The conversation, or the topic rather, the title is Securing the Future of Connected Healthcare, Strategies for Product Life Cycle Compliance and Protection. And Kaylin's going to do a fantastic job leading that. You can register at devicetalks.com. And you can register for free, watch live, get your questions answered right away, or watch on demand, get your questions answered less than right away, but certainly soonish. And it's a great way to learn how to medtech better. So make sure you do that. Of course, while you're at devicetalks.com, register to attend Device Talks West. That's happening on October 16th and 17th. We'll reference that in today's episode a bit. We'll actually talk a little bit about last year's very powerful Device Talks West. We will be recreating that magic at the Santa Clara Convention Center, so make sure you don't miss it. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Oh, finally, Chris Newmarker is back. We've got our Newmarker's Newsmakers. Be referencing some big stories reported by the Mass Device staff, including a great FDA piece by Danielle Kirsch. We've got some cool emails. Make sure you go to massdevice.com to find all this great medical device news. All right, without any further delay, let's get this podcast going. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
How are you, sir?
Tom Salemi. Good to be here, man. Good to be here.
Chris, I was thinking about this before we got on. What's your middle name? Are you willing to share that?
My middle
name. I was going to say your full name, but I don't know what your middle name
you're
is.
Like, yeah. You're like, you want me to also tell like the city I was born in?
Your mother's maiden name? We can. What initial does
what
this
What was your
with?
Favorite pet over the years, Chris?
Exactly. What street did you grow up on? I got this thing with one of the questions was, where did you meet your wife? And I know where I met my wife, but I keep getting it wrong. I'm like, what did I say? Like, there's only like five options and I've tried them all. Like, wrong. That's not where you met your wife. Like, all right. What did I say? But all right. Okay. We can bypass the middle initial thing.
Yes. Especially because I will say my middle name was my mom's maiden name.
Oh, well, there you go.
I can't. Yeah.
Mom wasn't planning ahead with that one.
Right? They're like, oh, it's been a nice tradition in the family for generations that the firstborn should have the middle name should be the maiden name. It's like, oh.
That's too funny.
Okay, yeah, right. There you go.
Yeah, forget you, hackers. We don't need CrowdStrike. We'll just keep this to ourselves.
I know. You know. It's here's a fun story. Like with our twin boy and girl, we have an 8-year-old, 2 6-year-olds. The twin boy and girl, the one's middle name is my wife's grandma's name, and then the boy, his middle name was my dad's middle name. So that was kind of fun. Yeah, we kind of drew some stuff from family history. Got a package now.
We had family over recently, and my wife said to one of my sons, who has my first name as their middle name.
Oh, that's cool.
It's like you're named after your grandfather. I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I thought they were named after me. It's like, like, how'd you slip that one by me? I thought that was my first name, but it's their great-grandfather's first name.
Wow. So
it works. It's a good name. Thomas is a good name.
Thomas is a good name. It's like,
yeah.
It's not a doubtful name at all.
Kids these days tend to go with Thomas more than Tom, I find. What do you think of your kids' classmates? Do they have Thomases or Toms in their classrooms?
Thomas. You know, I hear Tom more. I don't hear much Thomas. No.
Oh, really? Oh, we hear a lot of Thomases around here. Okay. Yeah, I could never stand Thomas, but yeah, he works
Tom's
for them.
A good, just sounds good, good, solid.
Yeah. Yeah, what's Tom up to? Yeah, Tom's a good guy. Yeah. Good old reliable
Our
Tom.
One kid's Gabe. It's just, hey, I mean, his full name's, he just hears Gabriel when, like, I need to really get his attention. Like, Gabriel.
So I was talking with one of your fellow Minnesotans today, and we were trying to make plans for a call. He's like, well, let me know because I'm going to the lake. I'm like, oh my God, you really said going to the lake.
They go to the lake, man.
They go to the lake.
That's right.
Yeah.
We're heading up to the lake. It could be any lake of the 10,000 we have.
That's the funny part. Like, we go to the Cape, obviously, but we just have one, Cape Cod. It's like, if you're going to the Cape, you're not going to Cape Ann. You're not going up to Cape Elizabeth. You're going to Cape Cod if you're going to the Cape.
You say the lake, it could be anything from, like, the big lake, Lake Superior, to, like, you know, going to Mille Lacs or going to, there's all kinds of lakes here.
Well, let's roll into the new markers.
I think we've given them enough grooving around today, Tom. I think we're good.
What is number five?
Number five.
New markers, newsmakers. Well, there, I got it now.
Imperative Care, the stroke treatment device company.
Great company. Yeah,
big name in our industry. A growing name. And they just completed a $150 million fundraise. And they also had some cool news about their board.
Yeah. Familiar face
joining as vice chair of the board. They got Chasey Petrovich joining as their vice chair.
That's great. Yeah. And this Imperative Care was a big part of Device Talks West last year. Will be a big part of Device Talks West 2024.
Coming up in October.
25. Coming up October 16th and 17th. They'll be giving a presentation. But the news that Chasey Petrovich, former CEO of Insulet, is now vice chair of Imperative Care, brought me back to CEO Fred Khoshavi's keynote interview at Device Talks West last year. Do you remember how we ended that conversation, Chris?
Oh, you know, I remember he had some very powerful words to say about, you know, the need for diversity in our industry.
He absolutely did. And we'll play it right here.
I'm going to say something. I don't mean to be kind of sexist or raise the ire of half of the population here. But I really do think that for medicine to shift into treating the patients as opposed to treating the disease, we need more women in medicine. We need more women in leadership in companies that are treating technologies for medicine. I'm not saying 100%, no. But I think we're woefully behind. And I believe that women in medicine and women in leadership in these companies will shift shift medicine to focusing on the patient as opposed to the disease. We're all kind of hammer and nail people.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, how can I ask another question? I'm dropping the mic, and we'll go have some time outside. So thank you, Fred Khoshavi, for sharing your story today.
Thank you, guys.
Yes, so he kind of brought down the house saying he had something controversial to say about women in leadership and brought down the house by saying we need more. Yeah. So he backed that up with the news this week. So it's great to have Chasey Petrovich as vice chair, and who knows? Yeah. I mean, I don't know where it goes from here, but it's a great addition, an important addition. So great news for Imperative Care.
She's a great leader in our industry. And also noting, I mean, she's on a few other, you know, boards in the industry as well, Exact Sciences, Ambu, Axena Health. So,
yeah. In fact, may I give a little news as to next week's episode?
Oh, yeah. Love it.
next week's episode should be scheduled to be my conversation with Jim Hollingshead from the CEO of Insulet, who, of course, followed Stacey Petrovic. And he indeed said that she was a very, 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 very tough act to follow, that she was a fantastic leader. So we'll have more from Insulet next week.
That's good.
All right, Chris Newmarker, what is number four?
Well, number four on the list, some more interesting personnel news. I mean, this has to do with the FDA. I mean, Jeff Shuren is retiring. I mean, the head of the Center for Device and Radiological Health, basically the top regulator in the United States here for medtech.
Big news. And as I posted on LinkedIn, I mean, when he took over in 2009, it's impossible to overstate how bad the relationship between the medtech industry and the FDA was. It was, I don't think it could ever break. Because the industry needs the FDA, but it was kind of at a breaking point. Entrepreneurs were frustrated at the process, the unpredictability in their minds or eyes or hearts of the FDA process, and there were a few high profile disappointments like Emphasis, which we've talked about on this podcast before, that has certainly done a complete 180 with Jeff Shuren in charge.
It's amazing that when I started covering medtech like over a decade ago now, that you still a lot of times saw, like, you know, a medical device company would first get their device approved in Europe, and then, you know, U.S. approval would follow because it was easier to, you know, at least the regulatory authorities in the EU had a reputation for being easier. Now, now it's flipped around. I mean, Europe has that new medical device regulation that's tight, that's, you know, considered more more strict, and the FDA has, you know, really improved their, you know, their, you know, just. It's just a lot easier to, you know, people in the industry say it's a lot easier to work with the FDA. I mean, they're still really, you know, working to make sure our devices are, you know, safe and effective, but, you know, but it's just like a much, much better experience for people who want to innovate.
And that's a great point, that it was definitely an OUS strategy before US, and it's completely turned around. So
completely flipped around. You know, it was interesting. He's been at the FDA for 28 years. And, you know, according to some internal communications in the FDA that got shared, I mean, he said he wanted to retire in 2020, but something came up that made him feel he shouldn't be abandoning his post at that point. You know,
Was it the Device Talks Weekly podcast launch in March 2020? Yeah.
You know what? That was it. He was like, you know, I was going to retire, but I started listening to Tom and Chris every week. Have we had him on?
No, I suspect I've never reached out and asked. I mean, I don't know.
You know what? Maybe might be the time. Maybe just, you know, you can't just retire and not come on Device Talks Weekly. So, like, Dr. Shuren, we'd really like to have you on this podcast.
Absolutely. If anyone listening knows him and wants to reach out on our behalf, we'd love to have him on. We'd also, of course, love to have on his acting director, Michelle Tarver, who's going to be taking over this month. Dr. Michelle Tarver will be acting director of FDA CDRH. So congratulations to her. I don't know how this plays into the election and stuff, like when acting may become become full-time. I don't know what the process is there.
That'll be interesting, yeah.
But she takes over on July 28th. So thank you, Jeff Shuren, and good luck, Dr. Tarver. All right.
Fantastic.
Let's roll on to number three, Chris Newmarker.
Well, number three on the list, our associate editor, Sean Hooley, has a roundup of seven neurotech companies you need to know. Like, basically, seven companies that have been getting attention from our audience, you know, like that have like gotten attention from us as we're doing our reporting and covering the industry. And, you know, it's just a really interesting space right now. I mean, like a decade ago is more about like, okay, we've, you know, got pacemaker technology. How can we create these pacemaker like devices, you know, where you run leads to the brain and the nervous system to do different things. But, you know, now it's, you know, these devices are getting smaller. In some cases they're non-invasive. Just some really interesting things going on right now. So I'd say make a guess what's on the list.
Yeah.
go check out this story. 7 neurotech companies you need to know.
I won't give them out, but I had not heard of number 7 or number 1. I hadn't heard of number 1, and they made some real news last month in June, so I should have.
Exactly. These are the newsmakers.
Huh? That's right. These are the newsmakers.
The newsmakers in neurotech. New markers, newsmakers,
subset,
neurotech.
Paragraph, neurotech. All right.
Well, we need to see show like a brain with like electricity flying in front of it.
All right, let us roll on to number 2 on this vaunted Newmarker's Newsmakers list.
Hey, number 2 on the list is, we actually have a little bit more personnel news here, like Inspire Medical Systems, which is really a well-known med tech company here around the Twin Cities. They have, you know, actually like talking about, a neurotech, they've got a really cool implantable, neurostimulation device to treat sleep apnea. And their chief operating officer, Philip Ebling, I hope I pronounced that right, Phil, is leaving the company. He'll be leaving, he's been there since June 2020, and his resignation takes effect August 9th.
And were we able to identify where he's going?
Not yet. I mean, the SEC filing saying he's resigning just said it was a private cardiology med tech company. So no updates yet on what that would be, but we'll be following that. He's going to be joining the corner office.
All right. Well, congratulations to him. Looking at his background, he was at Boston Scientific, so he probably got some cardiology. Yeah. St. Jude's, he's got some cardiology.
Yeah,
Abbott.
He's got game.
All right. Well, now we just have to wait for the other shoe to drop, Chris Newmarker.
Good luck to Phil.
Would that be number one? Are we gonna? Is this a two-parter?
And number one? No,
no, different story.
It's completely different.
Okay.
Actually, are you ready for number one? Let's
number
do number one.
One.
Number
on the
one.
Newmarker's Newsmakers list, Chris Newmarker.
Number one is I remember there were these two. These two fortune tellers a week ago, after that Edwards news saying there might be more Edwards acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And here it is.
Some of that critical therapies cash. Yep. Yep.
That's right. That's going to be rolling in from BD. And, they're going to be spending $1.2 billion to acquire Genevel Technology and Endotronix.
Mm-hmm. And Endotronix, of course, was our guest on last week's podcast. We had CEO Harry Rowland on there. And 5 days later, the company's acquired, Chris Newmarker. Coincidence?
I mean, Tom, you might need to grow that goatee back, maybe get a wizard hat. I don't know, man.
I imagine Endotronix was listening to this show over the weekend. Edwards Life Sciences.
Edwards.
And was like, let's give Harry a call. He sounds like a really intriguing company.
This is some cool technology. It's probably not what happened, but I like the idea, Tom. That sounds really good.
Tracking it for longer than 3 days. Yes.
But Genevalve, they've got their Trilogy heart valve system to treat aortic regurgitation, which is a real need in the space. And Endotronix has its implantable pulmonary artery pressure sensor that just received FDA approval last month. So I mean, this is really like Edwards making it a play to kind of like diversify it. It's cardiology tech, so it's it comes along actually on the same day today. We're talking on Thursday on the heels of this news yesterday evening, and Edwards had kind of like a pretty tough second quarter earnings report. Actually, their stock is down more than 30% right now for the day. So they're, they got some challenges they're working through right now. It was interesting. I mean, their TAVR sales are still growing. I mean, that's their huge part of their business, but the momentum isn't what the analysts wanted it to be. And kind of the reason that I saw, when I was reading the analyst reports this morning, I mean, I read all these analyst reports so that our audience doesn't have to. So they were saying that the success that Edwards is seeing in its transcatheter mitral and tricuspid therapies is actually eating into their TAVR revenue
right
now. because it's you know, there's, you know, they said that the analysts said they heard on the calls that the success of those new therapies was causing like hospital workflow pressures in the cath lab, and that was reducing the amount of TAVR procedures they were able to do. So, you know, they actually got a downgrade from Truist over this. But on the flip side, William Baer is sticking with Outperform because they're saying, you know, we think this is just going to be a transient issue. So, you know, eventually this will get worked out and they'll figure out how to do, you know, more TMTM procedures and more TAVR procedures, you know, but I guess the question is just how long is it going to take for the health providers just to get that all worked out?
Yeah. You would think during a transition of this scope and size that it would take, there'd be probably a year or so until things got resettled. So.
Yeah. So it seems like some of the analysts were skeptical whether.
And this is not investment advice, believe me.
No. Yeah, don't listen to us.
It's just a dumb guy's opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We just write about this stuff. Yeah. Don't go like, socking away some EW shares right now.
I don't want the angry comments on LinkedIn, Chris Neumarker. I don't want them. Those investors get angry real fast.
I lost like Junior's like college savings. no, don't listen.
No, do not listen. To us, but, yeah, exactly. Well, cool. It's cool that Edwards is stocking up on the structural heart properties, and I'm sure it's going to be. I'm not sure of anything. Again, this is just an opinion, but it's going to take some time to get all these products in line. Cool stuff.
It'll take them a while to get that going, but yeah, it's nice to see. Especially, I mean, you were telling me there's been kind of a drought in acquisition deals for ACPAC.
We didn't have John Norris on last week. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, it was the first half of 2024. There were two deals, very small deals. Nothing really to speak of. So this will certainly inflate the second half numbers and probably bring us in line with some sort of reasonable levels at the end of the year. But that's sometimes why these quarterly things, you just need to give it some time. But
I've been covering like VC deal levels for forever now. And yeah, you just don't. It's you really don't want to like go quarter by quarter, you know, because you really need to look at the aggregate of the year. I mean, like one quarter to one quarter. I mean, you could just have like a spring where stuff just doesn't happen, and then like people get like, okay, we're ready, and all the stuff happens in the summer or the fall or whatever. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Kristen. Well, congratulations again to the folks at Endotronics, of course, our guests last week. And I just looked at the plug this into the Google machine. Genevalve Technologies is 20 minutes and 13.1 miles, depending upon your path, away from Edwards Life Sciences. So they're neighbors. So
there you go.
Their commute. Easy. Commute's not too much longer if they have to move the operations. But
there you go.
All righty. Well, Chris Neumarker, good stuff as always. Great stuff as always. And
it's awesome.
We'll have you back next week. Thanks, bud.
See you in a week, man. See you, buddy.
This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? You know, getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
Chris Landon, welcome back to the podcast.
Tom, it's been a hot minute. It's great to be back.
It has. It has. Yeah, you were on, I've just looked back, you were our guest in October, November 2020. So we were neck deep in COVID at the time.
Yeah.
The podcast was probably about 6 months old. And I was surprised when I listened. I said, Chris, I haven't asked this question of a guest before, but tell us how you got into medtech. I think you were the first person that I kind of opened up an episode trying to find out a bit about their backgrounds. I had done it for previous podcasts, but this was, you were the first guinea pig for Device Talk.
Well, I'm glad to have been a guinea pig. I hope we, you know, thinking back to that conversation, that we've completed our mission of eliminating the world of pumpkin sausage, but maybe we haven't
yet. I don't think so, sir. That scourge just continues on. But we're in the heat of summer, so we can not worry about that for a few months. People can obviously go back and listen to the whole episode. This is when you had just, I don't know if you just left Medtronic and joined Philips, but it was shortly after that transition. But talk a bit about your path into medtech, because I think it's kind of topical and timely to and relevant to what you're doing now.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Tom. And, you know, I think my path to medtech really started not long after I started my career coming out of the University of Washington in a consulting position with Deloitte. I really got some good training as I went through that process of being a consultant. I learned how to do things like problem solve, manage projects, communicate. But I didn't find a lot of passion for the work that I was doing. So when I went back and I did my MBA in law school in Lausanne, Switzerland, I came across the former CEO of Medtronic, Bill George, and through interactions with Bill, I started to see what real opportunity there was in the world of medtech, particularly around this idea of putting patients at the center of what it is we do and making mm-hmm. that our mission and building businesses around intervening on patients' behalf, so whether we're trying to drive a clinical outcome or improve workflow so that patients can get better access to healthcare. I just found that to be a really meaningful mission. And when I decided to go all in on medtech and start my career at Medtronic, I started doing the only job I knew how to do, which was economics. And then I started at Medtronic in the world of healthcare economics, leveraging some of the background that I had in my previous education. And as I was going through the development, and Medtronic has a wonderful career development opportunities for young professionals, I started really getting a taste for leadership. And after mm-hmm. spending some years investing in my own skill sets and investing in opportunities that were stretching me to try on different things, whether it was strategy or marketing or sales, I finally was able to convince some of my sponsors within the company to give me a chance at general management. And once I made that movement, move into general management, my first general manager job was in degenerative spine at Medtronic. I've really started getting this this thirst for learning more about leadership itself and learning how to bring teams together, learn how to scale teams across businesses, across challenges, and all in service of patients at the end of the day. And so that's been my journey. I've been trying, as I have moved along in this medical device world, I've been trying to continue to layer on my capability set as a leader, engaging people, building teams, trying to solve big, hairy, thorny problems. And that's ultimately led me to my last position at Philips, and ultimately has got me here to the CEO role here at Natus Medical.
So as someone who is advocated for themselves to get moved into a leadership track, and I'm sure someone who's worked now as a mentor or a sponsor or a champion for younger professionals, what kind of advice would you give to someone who feels they're ready for more? How do they demonstrate that? How do they get their mentors to see that? What advice would you give them?
That's a great question. I think there's a couple things that I advise young aspiring leaders. The first is to really invest in themselves, acquire skill sets, particularly in medical devices, which are such complicated businesses. Invest in skill sets that allow you to maybe not be an expert in everything, but at least have an idea of what everybody does and what good looks like when they do it well. Mm-hmm. Investing in those foundational skills is what ultimately you're going to tap into as a leader. The second thing I advise people to do is seek out mentorship. And mentorship can come in many forms, whether we're talking about coaching, which happens at a very specific time in your life, or when it becomes, you know, something that's more lifelong in terms of helping you develop at different stages, challenging you with that independent look that and that mirror that's reflecting at you, not with the idea of criticizing, but helping you stretch yourself into positions. And then the third type of mentor are people who can actually help place you into your roles at the end of the day. So developing that cadre of relationships and mentorships, I think, is the second piece of advice. And then the third thing that I advise people to do is when you really get to the point where you feel like you're ready to move into those leadership roles, start to identify what kind of leader you're going to be, set your goal for yourself, and stretch into that. And this is not unlike any other project that you set for yourself. You want to set a goal, you want to set timelines, you want to set objectives that you're going to meet along the way that you can count as milestones, so you know that you're making progress. I always have advocated for continuing those mentoring relationships well into that journey, because that is ultimately how you're going to be challenged and stretch even further.
I always hesitate sometimes to delve too deeply into these questions, but I'm always fascinated. The mentorship approach, it's obviously it sounds great, but how does one choose a mentor, and how sort of formal is that relationship? I mean, is there an understanding between the two that I'm the mentor and you're the mentoree? Is it more just an issue of proximity or regular contact? What does that relationship, what does a good mentor mentee relationship look like?
I've benefited from many different types of mentors over my career. And I'm often asked this very question, how do you engage one? How do you identify one? What have you?
Yeah.
The best way I can answer that, I'm thinking back to a conversation I had with my wife not too long ago. And she was talking about a completely different subject, but she was talking about relationships that she has with people. And she used a phrase that I think really neatly, succinctly describes how I've approached relationships with mentors, which is, I meet people who come into my life for a reason, or sometimes a season, or sometimes a lifetime. And as I think about my mentors, they all kind of fit that mold. I've had many coaches who are mentors to me, but served a very specific purpose. We were trying to drive one developmental item, or maybe two developmental items. And we set basically a work plan for ourselves that included developmental milestones that could be objectively measured. And eventually I concluded that relationship. And those mentors are not hard to find. There's a lot of people who are coaches out there that position themselves right directly in front of you and are willing to work with you in that way. Then there's the reason types of mentors. And these are mentors that are going to help you maybe with a broader set of objectives to get you to a certain place in your life. Mm-hmm. I found this very much so at Medtronic. I had several mentors who were helping advise me on my journey to becoming a general manager and ultimately a leader in the business. And these folks may not necessarily have envisioned a timeline or maybe put specific objectives in front of me, but they did give me feedback and they helped me fill in the blanks in terms of the things that needed to be done in order to position oneself for the goals and objectives that I had. And then there's the lifetime mentors. And those are the people that enter your life and you just become close with them in a way that allows you to be open, honest, vulnerable with them so that they can provide feedback to you on any number of topics that you ultimately can work into your career, into your life, into your relationships, whatever the case may be. There's no secret sauce. There's a gut feel to this. It's really about being honest about what your goals and objectives are with people, going out and finding the opportunities to meet people so that you can, you know, get a sense of whether or not it might even be possible to develop a relationship, and then investing time and communication into those relationships once you get a sense that they might lead to some type of more formal mentorship arrangement.
That's great. So it's a reason, a season, or a lifetime. Yeah. The three categories. I like that.
I can't
That's
take
really
credit
great.
For that. My wife definitely dropped that knowledge on me.
Yeah. Now you footnoted that correctly. No one will accuse you of stealing that idea. So going back to your origin story a bit, I remember in the previous podcast you talked about Bill Hawkins, and I think what you said really got you was a video he showed of a concert pianist. I think who had Parkinson's.
Yeah. So this is how I kind of transitioned into medical devices. This is the moment I realized, wow, there's real purpose here.
Yeah.
Serving patients. And this was actually Bill George that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bill George. I knew I was saying. Yeah. Yeah, Bill George.
Bill George. Although Bill Hawkins has been a great. Well, and I certainly want to acknowledge that. But Bill introduced me to a few people at Medtronic early in my process as I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I actually came across a marketing leader in the company who shared this video with me. And it was a wonderful video that Medtronic had produced in support of their neuro business. And it was an elderly patient who described his situation to an interviewer that he was previously a concert pianist, and he had developed Parkinson's, and the Parkinson's had made it impossible for him to continue to play piano and to do the thing that he loved to do. So he had ultimately been outfitted with a deep brain stimulation device to help him with his tremors. And I remember in that video that the interviewer asked him to sit down and play play a piece on the piano while he was shaking with his tremors. And of course, he wasn't able to do that. But once he was able to turn on his deep brain stimulation device, you could just see the tremors just kind of fade away. And then for about a minute or two, he played this beautiful piece of music. And I just remember thinking, my goodness, this is what we get to do in medtech. We get to take all these great engineering capabilities, all these great insights that we have around technology, and figure out how to apply it to the betterment of life. And honestly, if you, and I didn't mean to make this a segment about Medtronic, but if you follow Medtronic's story all the way back to Earl Bakken and how we even got to the battery-powered pacemaker, you see that type of innovation and that partnership with the clinical community play out in the medical technology community. And of course, now we have so many great companies that all basically operate in the exact same way in terms of identifying big, hairy problems that the combination of technology and innovation with clinical expertise can help solve. And this partnership that we have with the clinical community as innovators in order to solve these problems is very compelling. I think it's why people like me get in this industry and we stay in it.
That's amazing. No, I don't think you can ever go wrong with a Medtronic legacy story. It's always a good one, but it does tie us to your company that you're now CEO of today, Natus, which is a neuro company. But talk a bit about Natus's portfolio. It's one, I'm sure it's a company that folks have heard of, but I don't know if people really have unpacked your product offerings.
Yeah, the Natus Neuro, which is the company I'm the CEO of, is the market leader, global market leader in neurodiagnostics technologies. And what we do fundamentally is take diagnostic technologies and apply it to the challenge of helping patients that are having some kind of neurological challenge, neurological disease, help them find the right care pathway so that they can get treated and ultimately get back to living the lives that they want to live. We are organized into three basic product categories or clinical categories, if you will. We have a brain care division, which really focuses on diagnostics and support for patients with primarily epilepsy, but also other types of neurodegenerative conditions or neurocritical care conditions that are being treated in different parts of the hospital. We have a neuropathways division, which also is really focused on neuromuscular intervention and helping to diagnose those types of diseases. And then the third, we do have a small business that's focused on the neurocritical care unit and helping clinicians care for those patients that show up in those parts of the hospital, getting them into the right care pathways as well.
So do each of the groups draw from the same technology? Is it all a monitoring technology, or what functions do your products provide or deliver?
Yeah, so by and large, we are monitoring and looking for the signals that that the brain or the neurosystem produce in order to identify where disease or where injury might be occurring. So for instance, we are the global market leader in putting out EEG machines into the market. EEG machines are primarily used by neurologists to diagnose patients with epilepsy. And as you may not know, epilepsy is a very prevalent disease. There's about 3.5 million people in the U.S. that that have epilepsy, and 500,000 of those are children. And as you might be able to imagine, when a parent sees a child have some type of seizure, it can be a very scary, very daunting challenge. And so our technology is used to help identify where the disease might be, what might be causing the patient to have those kinds of symptoms, and then ultimately to help clinicians figure out the right care pathway and therapeutic intervention for that patient, whether it be medical or surgical in nature.
So are your customers primarily hospitals, or do you sell to ASCs?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have primarily we sell into sites of care like hospitals, private labs, sometimes office-based labs. Some of our products are meant to provide monitoring for patients remotely so that we can send patients back into the home. So that they can be monitored remotely and diagnosed at home. So we tend to go where the patient is. Now, traditionally, our business has been very focused on epilepsy labs or sleep diagnostic labs, for instance, where patients go and they're monitored for long periods of time to get to the right diagnosis. Increasingly, we're seeing demand for neuromonitoring happen in other sites of the hospital, whether we're talking about the emergency room, or the ICU. And of course, as I just mentioned, we're also seeing a lot of demand for patients to be monitored at home. Those meeting those demands is a challenge because traditionally our systems are big, clunky hardware systems that are in carts. They have a lot of electrodes. They're hard to manage. I mean, imagine having an EKG, but with 200 electrodes as opposed to your standard cardiology suite. So there's a lot of logistical hurdles to get over as we try to accommodate where the demand is for this type of monitoring. But the good news is there's a lot of innovation happening, whether the innovation is happening at the software level, whether the innovation is happening with AI. A lot of types of innovations are allowing us to change the form factors for the physical pieces of the hardware that interface with the patient, and allowing us also to reimagine exactly how patient workflows are, and allowing the diagnostics to occur where the patient needs to be at any given time.
So what are those, what does that evolution look like? Are we looking at smaller devices, handheld devices? In terms, I guess, just physical attributes of the device, give me a sense of where we're headed in this space.
The devices themselves come in all shapes or forms, depending on what we're trying to diagnose at the end of the day. It's not really that. Where the evolution is happening, of course, is on the software side and with the advent of AI. If you think about EEG, it's very similar to an EKG. It's a series of waveforms that are being produced by electrodes attached to the skin or sometimes inserted directly into the brain. And each of those waveforms is a signal of some sort that that can be interpreted to help a physician or clinician orient himself or herself to what is happening with the patient's condition. When you have all these electrodes producing all these waveforms and you start monitoring the patient for a longer period of time, keeping in mind the longer you look for something, the more likely you're going to find you're going to be to find it. It becomes massive amounts of data, and it's really hard for technicians or clinicians to keep up with all of that data. And in fact, if you're not trained as a neurologist, you probably can't interpret it at all. But if you can make innovations that bring and automate some of that monitoring using machine learning and AI techniques, you can actually scale the intervention to different sites of care with different types of clinician, with different types of expertise, enabling that kind of monitoring to occur and to allow disease to be diagnosed and therapy to be prescribed for patients who might be having some kind of ailment. And that's where the industry is ultimately going. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about EEG, which is monitoring brain, or doing sleep diagnostics, or doing neuropathway diagnostics. That same concept of innovation, of putting intelligence into the cloud that amplifies the capabilities of clinicians and allows patients to be diagnosed in different sites of care, is where growth is going to come from, and is what's going to allow us ultimately to treat more patients.
So what is that side of things, or what will that look like? Are you going to be getting into products that, you're collecting the information, you're going to be analyzing the information. what's next and sort of that? Is it how do you provide that information? How will you provide that information differently to the physician? What does that look like?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do that at the end of the day, and we've got, I think, you know, quite a few irons in the fire when it comes to innovation around how we want to intervene with patients and help physicians reimagine care pathways for these patients. But I'm going to take a step back and tell you, really, it's really about improving access to care. We see, for instance, technologies like EEGs. Or EEGs themselves as basically another vital sign for the patient, a vital sign that can be helped, that can be used to understand the patient's general condition and their general state of health. However, because of how complicated these signals can be and how hard they are to interpret, it's really difficult for us to adopt that kind of signal as a true vital sign, as a tool that we use to assess health. By bringing the innovation up into the cloud, by amassing data, training algorithms to be able to supplement clinicians' capabilities, no matter what their skill sets are, we imagine this kind of screening and diagnostic capability extending into other types of areas of care in the hospital, as well as extending out geographically to places where maybe there isn't a strong diagnostic capability because of a lack of fundamental hardware in the hospitals or trained staff or whatever the case may be. So that's the problem we're ultimately trying to solve. We're trying to make ubiquitous the ability to diagnose and manage the signals, the neurological signals that the body is producing. The way we do that at the end of the day is of course we simplify the process of interpreting these reports and these signals once these studies are done on patients. That's a big part of it. Clinicians still need to be present and part of this because AI can't you know, address some of the contextualization that physicians naturally do when they do workups and assessments of patients. So that's a big part of it. But we also can imagine doing monitoring for patients going forward, whether we're talking about physically monitoring a patient who has been symptomatic with a specific disease, or if we're talking about screening out patients who might be suspected of having some kind of condition in the future, and taking that burden off the healthcare system, taking it onto ourselves, and then producing insights for clinicians so that they can more quickly get patients in the right care pathway.
So I would imagine with this amount of data too, you've got some opportunities for partnerships, maybe with companies developing devices or pharma or things like that. Or is that something you're currently in or exploring, or am I just wacky way off base?
No, absolutely. this is an exciting world, and I think all of us need to be looking as leaders for medical technology businesses, we need to be looking at where we can partner to accelerate the adoption of digitalization of healthcare. I mean, these are massive opportunities to change the way that the healthcare is delivered, but it requires a few fundamental things. First of all, it requires a lot of technical expertise in order to develop data strategies, data infrastructures, as well as AI algorithms. Those capabilities aren't spread evenly across the entire market. And so finding partners who can help bring that technical skill sets to the table is really important. Second of all, it requires access to a lot of data. As you well know, and I know you've had on your show before, seeing an AI vision come to life requires a lot of data in order to be able to train algorithms, validate algorithms, and to be able to ultimately improve those algorithms over time. And so partnering with your clinical communities, partnering with other companies that have access to data or complementary data is also really important as you think about how you want to get to market at the end of the day. So we actually are engaged in this whole ecosystem of technology and partnerships, and we are always looking to add more partnerships to the fold if it helps us pursue our mission.
We hear a lot of companies talking about incorporating AI into what they do. How do you assure those who you're talking to, be it reporters or investors or anybody else, that you know what you're doing is really more than just saying we use AI, but you're really employing AI? What sort of disciplines are you applying to your application of AI to really demonstrate that that AI is a core part of what you do?
Well, I would say that I guess to kind of flip that question on its head a little bit, it starts with answering the question, why is AI useful to me at all? Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you talk to a neurologist who works in an epilepsy lab, the answer may be we don't really need that. We have the tools and equipment that we need. We understand how to read the output of these. We have care pathways that are efficient enough to take care of the patients that we see. It may not be actually all that useful for us at the end of the day. So what we really need to do is take a step back and look at the world from a patient's point of view. And looking at the world from a patient's point of view reveals a couple things. First of all, it reveals not every patient who could benefit from these type of diagnostics and could benefit from being put into one of these care pathways is getting access to these technologies. That becomes a real thing. We also see that diagnostic yields for patients may not be as high as they need to be in order to make sure patients get the right care. And so we start asking ourselves at the end of the day, what can we do to solve those problems? And when we start framing the challenges from the patient's point of view for our clinicians, then it becomes revealed, yeah, you know what, there is probably opportunity here. And so how do we make this real at the end of the day? We start with the use case. We start with the patient challenge that we're trying to solve. And then we innovate around that particular challenge. And in that way, it's not really any different than innovation that you'd have for an implantable device or disposable device that's used in an interventional procedure of some sort. It really is about the patient condition you're trying to solve, the situation you're trying to solve, making sure that there's a patient benefit, a clinician benefit, an economic benefit, and then driving the innovation that way. We're actually in the process right now of launching a recent update to our neuromonitoring software that has the industry's first AI algorithm built into it. And this algorithm is really a kind of a first attempt at facilitating just simple process flow improvements for the physician so that they can reduce the amount of time that they're spending on reading EEG studies and increase the amount of time that they're spending with patients or even bringing in more patients for diagnostics. And we want to see how that works. It's just trying to solve that basic workflow problem as we then will layer on top of that as we go along.
Final question, getting away from AI and data, just about your role as CEO. You joined in March, just a couple of months ago. I thought it was longer than that. If you have a mentee who's asking you, look, I'm becoming a CEO, what have you learned so far? You're only 3 months in, but is it what you expected? Were you prepared for it? And what advice were you, of course, you're prepared for it, but what advice would you give somebody who's making a similar transition?
That's a great question. I am just really at a point now, 4 months, 5 months into my job now, where I'm doing that kind of reflection. What have I learned in my first 100 days? What surprised me? What's maybe not surprising? And I guess there's a couple things that I point out. First and foremost, the fundamental step from going to running an organization, doesn't matter how many dollars are in that organization, but going from being part of a leadership team where the buck doesn't necessarily stop with you to having sole responsibility is a major step. It's a major adjustment. There is no doubt about it. It can be overwhelming for anyone who has any sense of responsibility. You realize, oh my gosh, everything now lies on me. But then once you get over that shock and awe, what I found really quickly is to go back to how I developed and what I've been trained to do and what my mentors have instructed me to do. Build your team, get a hold of the fundamentals, understand the fundamentals really well, understand what makes the business work and what customers value, and then start from there and then work out. Try to shrink your world a little bit and break the thing off into pieces. And so I've done that. In my first 100 days, I went out to every single site that we have, save a couple of really small satellite locations. I went to where the work was being done. I walked the lines. I met with the next level down of leadership. I didn't just stop with my own team. And I really developed a fundamental understanding of the business. I also developed a fundamental understanding of the culture and the way people were motivated and by what, and what were the gaps in that. So, you know, I kept a journal as I went. I recorded all my notes, and I started in doing that, amassing both an understanding of the business, but also kind of a punch list of things that I knew I could get after, some low hanging fruit items that I think I could affect, as well as a charting of some of the bigger issues. And so taking your time, even though you feel that overwhelming urge to go really, really fast and to start making changes, I think is really important in order to make the right changes and to build confidence among your team that you're being thoughtful about your leadership. The second lesson and recommendation I'd give to anyone making my transition is do whatever you've been doing to get feedback from your mentors or those who give you feedback, and then put that on hyperdrive. Get more feedback constantly as you go. I think the CEOs that fail probably fail because maybe they quit taking that feedback and they think they got it all figured out. I can't tell you how many blind spots have been pointed out to me in just my first 4 months on the job by people who walked this path before me. And it's been so helpful. It's helped me really, you know, put my fingers in some gaps in the dam in order to kind of keep things rolling. But also it's helped me get a lot of confidence in terms of the decisions I am making and getting on top of the things I got to do to run the business. So there's a lot of positive momentum that comes from just that kind of engagement with people. And I think I've found it to be very useful.
Fantastic. Well, you're always very thoughtful and generous with your thoughts. I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks for joining us again on the podcast.
Tom, it's a blast. You can have me back anytime. I can't wait to share even more with you after we've brought some new innovation to the market in the next few years.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. It's great to have you here. Once again, make sure you register for this first-in-a-lifetime, definitely not once-in-a-lifetime, opportunity to hear someone else lead a Device Talks Tuesdays discussion. Kayleen Brown will be leading the folks from Azurio on next Tuesday's session. You can go to devicetalks.com to register. It's called Securing the Future of Connected Healthcare, Strategies for Product Lifecycle Compliance and Protection. So make sure you check that out. Of course, register for Device Talks West while you're on devicetalks.com, or you can go to west.devicetalks.com. Register now, save yourself a couple $100. Lots of great speakers being added. It's going to be a great couple of days. So go to west.devicetalks.com. Finally, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We've got a Intuitive Talks coming out next week, as I mentioned. We'll have another Device Talks Weekly podcast that I mentioned in this episode. So it's a great way to stay informed, subscribe on any major podcast player. And of course, please do share this episode on social media. When you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi, connect with our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, connect with Chris Newmarker. We'd love to be part of those med tech conversations. All right, folks, that's a wrap. Really great to have you here, working on a lot of great stuff we're going to be sending your way soon. So until then, take care. Have a great day.